what we did last week. Now, I did mention last week, it'd be real nice if, you know, we could do a bit of a little bit of a survey, sort of what are sort of the top concerns when you think about culture, what are some of the top concerns? And I just want you to maybe think about, I don't have paper and pens and stuff like that to hand out, but think about that through the first half, and maybe when we start off the second, we're going to have a break today, so that'll give you a chance to get up and move around and not have to deal with the hard seats for it. But anyways, when we come back from the second half, maybe we'll just open up with a little bit of a chance for everybody to sort of articulate some of their own concerns about what they see in culture, which sort of you would put as sort of, think of what you would sort of prioritize. What, and that gives me a little bit of good feedback for where I really want to focus in weeks to come. So I have a bit of an idea where I'm going with this. We're kind of starting off sort of like you could say first principles, so some of the most general basic ideas. And then we're working our way down into concrete ideas. And so off the bat, it's going to seem like this is kind of abstract. Well, you have to start off a little bit abstract sometimes, and then you get down to the more concrete. But, and this is really where we're at. Worldviews are precisely that. We're dealing with the very basic foundational belief systems that we all have. It's a question of, you know, it's a question of how do we live out our Christian worldview in a culture surrounding us which has lost its biblical Christian worldview, and how do you engage that? And I'll tell you what, like I know that you used to be able to, a lot of, you'd recognize that if you've been around for a while, street preachers is not a thing anymore. You're probably just not going to have much success doing that. There used to be presuppositions that society had which were biblical. So they understood the notion of sin and stuff like that, and they at least knew they had they were at least somewhat articulate in understanding of the Bible. And now you got some of the bravest minds, strongest minds going on the shows like Jeopardy, and they can't even answer basic Bible questions and answers. So that's where we come to in society. That's what we have to deal with, but we're called to address that. And so we will do our best to do so. We went through a number of things. What is a worldview? What is culture? And like we said, we just kind of mentioned worldview is kind of this very basic underlying set of assumptions that we all carry. And a lot of people, sometimes you can reflect on them, you think about them. Other times, most people just kind of go through life not really thinking about it. It's just there. Culture, on the other hand, is really the set of meanings and values that, which are in many ways derivative from your worldview, and how those meanings and values get practiced in society, how they get portrayed, how they get presented, the art world, the educational world, and the technological world, every sphere of society. So in a certain sense, falls under this scope of culture. And a culture is usually something, it's not just, a culture is not something that you personally have, it's something that is shared. Now, we talked about the history of the word culture, how it's gone through different meanings. It used to mean, you know, obviously cultivate, as in a garden. It used to speak it more metaphorically as the cultivation of the mind or the soul, through the development of virtues, intellectual virtues, moral virtues. And then it gets sort of readapted, reappropriated by anthropologists and sociologists to have a whole different meaning, which sort of reflects this cultivation of the way we think and so forth in society. So when we talk about culture, we don't talk about a culture. Usually we talk about a culture, cultures, different cultures. There are subcultures within overriding cultures and so forth, that it's not something you can just define and say that is a, it's this idea, it's a general idea where you have these shared sets of values and meanings and so forth. So that's a little bit of review from last week. And then we talked about Christ and culture, and that's kind of this understanding that sometimes Richard Niebuhr wrote this book, Christ and Culture, a number of years ago, and it's very popular. It's a way sort of denominationally, roughly speaking, I wouldn't necessarily say all denominations would subscribe to this, but it's a way of sort of thinking about different theological approaches to culture. You could take the position that Christ is against culture, opposed to culture. We have nothing to do with the world, so we sort of cloister ourselves as our own culture to protect ourselves from the world, and so we have nothing to do with it. Then there's Christ for culture, which has been more associated with like the Protestant liberal tradition, where anything that goes in culture can be more or less taken up by Christians or the church and appropriated, and there's very little discretion about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And then there are three other sort of middle perspectives that fall in there: Christ above culture, Christ in paradox with culture, and then Christ who redeems culture, as it were. And that is roughly, it's what you consider it sort of the Roman Catholic tradition, the Lutheran tradition, and the Reformed tradition. You know, they're all kind of, it's a different way of looking at, there's parts, it's basically like saying, or at least for the Christ above culture and Christ redeeming culture, it's more of this, there are parts of culture which are good, and there are parts of culture which are not so good. So then what's the focus of the Christian's engagement with culture? Well, you have to be critical of culture, but you're calling the culture to something higher, or you're trying to redeem the culture, sort of, recognize that there's evil in it and it has to be redeemed. And then there's the Christ in paradox with culture, which is like, this is what we're stuck with. We're all sinners. The world's sinful. We're sinful. And we're called to this different, higher level of living, but we just have to accept the fact that we're all fallen. And so you're stuck in this paradox, which is more associated with the Lutheran tradition, like I said. But again, some of these denominations might want to question that. But anyways, we had a few verses which we talked about where I think the emphasis, my focus, is going to be on this aspect that not everything in culture is evil. Not everything in culture is good. But we are called as Christians to engage culture. That the Great Commission would not make any sense at all unless it were to mean you've got to engage culture. And you've got to do it on the terms, but the terms in which you engage it on is the gospel. You're presenting the gospel to the people who need it. And that's transformative. That will transform culture. And it's calling the culture, as it were, to something that is higher. God's calling is something higher than living out our own selfish lives here in this world. So anyways, today, we're going to move on. We had a few more slides from the presentation that I had from last week, which we didn't make it through. And we're just going to work at this, at our whatever pace that's comfortable, and slow me down or speed me up as it need be. But one of the thinkers that I studied during my studies was Bernard Lonergan. He was a Canadian philosopher and theologian, and one of the books he wrote is called Method and Theology. And when I was doing my dissertation, a certain part of that involved what this section from one of his chapters in his books called, he described as the scale of values. So what is a value? Well, it's kind of like the word, it's something that is of importance to you. And it has the implicit in it is the notion of good or evil, of course. There's a certain sense in which we prioritize values. There's also a sense in which certain values influence each other. And let's start off with what he calls vital values. These are what we would call particular goods. You are sitting down with a glass of water in front of you and a snack. Those are particular goods. They could be needs. If you've been out in a desert for a long time and you're really thirsty, water is a desperate need. If you've had lots of water and you've been out in the lake all day and you've been drinking all day, it's probably not that valuable at that moment, but it is a particular good. and as is anything such as play. Playing sports, or as a child, being able to play with your peers, that is a particular good. The clothing that you wear, exercise, education, entertainment, air conditioning, that's a particular good. In the winter, it's heat. So all of these things are, and I say particular good, we usually associate particular goods in this case with material goods. They're things that just because as humans, we need these things in order to survive and so forth. So this is kind of fairly self-explanatory. And even the word vital kind of gives off the sense we need these. These are important for us as humans. And if we don't have them, you know, there's a bit of a risk, at least to our physical well-being. Now, they could also say that this is, it gets a little bit, it's not necessarily physical things. Reading a book is a particular good. And that's a very spiritual activity. So we can't just say it's all physical or material, but it's particular insofar as it's something we're thinking about you as an individual requiring something or needing something or even just wanting something. Next we move on to social values or social order. So when you live in society, it's ingrained within the human mindset to say, we all need these goods. So let's organize a system of participation and cooperation whereby we distribute these goods to a group as a whole so that we can all participate in these vital goods. So anything like I have written down here, a political order, so that we have law and order in society, the police, police officers or a legal system, a judiciary, an economic order, a banking system, an education system, a church service. All of these things are what we call goods of order. They've been structured, intellectually structured. It's a rational system organized for the good of the whole. We move beyond the particular good of each individual onto the good of the group. So any type of civilized society is kind of often associated with this very aspect that we organize ourselves in certain ways so that these goods get distributed to everyone. We bicker and we complain about what system works best. Is it socialist or is it capitalist? Is it this or that? But the fact is we think those are important. We value them. So that's kind of a bit of a higher order, as it were. Next, we move on to cultural values, and in many ways, this is what we're focusing on. And this is, I won't present anything other than what we've talked about, it's the belief and values that infuse a society, including a higher level reflection upon the meaning and values, which we often associate with higher education that gradually infuse a culture. So here we're talking about a level above simply just structuring aside. Here we begin to get a little bit more reflective. What is it that is good? What is truly? So when we're talking, we may live in a system which we call, you know, a mixed economy, let's say capitalism plus a bit of socialism or something like that. But then we can sit back and we can start questioning, is this the best order that we could live in? That's you're doing that type of reflection. It's a philosophical reflection. It's more philosophical, and it's being done at a level where you don't just accept the order as it is. You're beginning to question, is it really good? And then you begin to, so when we talk about development of societies, it's usually done at this cultural level, this higher reflective level, where we begin to say, is this really good? Or is it not? And so usually this is why culture is sometimes associated with the academic aspect of society. And we prize academia precisely for this good. But this is also what we do when we gather together also at church, is to reflect upon about what is the true good that God wants us to do, about what is and how that impacts society. And so this is this is kind of what Lonergan has in mind at the level of cultural values. Now, okay, at the same time, we talk about vital values, we talk about social values, and we talk about cultural values. One thing we should keep in mind is that they influence each other. A society is limited to certain types of vital goods, and the types of vital goods that are present may not be present in other societies, and so the good of order will be structured differently precisely because there are different types of vital goods given in that society. And that in turn, that social order which becomes structured will also influence the way you think at the level of culture. But then it also works the other way around. Culture influences, we can do this a better way. Let's do this a better way. And then what happens in the academic circles oftentimes works its way down into the social, political order, which then gets infused to everybody else. And so you can see that it works both ways. And then Lonergan moves on to this notion of personal values. Now, this is a bit, it can be a little bit confusing. What he's talking about here is basically this. Each person is a rational creature. And because if you were to analyze, you know, a dog herd or a wolf herd or something like that, or like lions or whatever, you go, they don't live at this level of intelligence. They don't have a language. They don't have a culture. They don't have society. They have vital goods, but they have no they don't necessarily have any type of organization other than what they do by instinct. So you might have a lion pride all working together to take down an antelope, but it's an instinctive thing. They're not taught that. We as humans have this thing called reason. And we have volition, the freedom to choose one thing over another. And so when he says, at the level of personal values, we have to talk about the human person as originator of meanings and values. Meanings and values are not static. They change. Culture, as we know, is changing because you have human minds at work, whether for good or for evil, originating meanings and values. That may mean changing the meaning of words that have been around, or it may mean creating whole new words, whether it's done in the field of science or whether it's done in the field of gender studies or whatever. This is the recognition that we as human persons are the originators of meaning and values. Now, he means on top of that, and in the recognition that the good and the health of the culture, the good and the health of the social order, and the distribution of vital goods, and the vital goods in which we choose, is also impacted upon where the spiritual state of that person is. Is that person who's originating meanings and values doing their reflection based on biases that blind him to the needs of many or whatever? Or is that person's thinking been, you know, is it virtuous? Is it actually looking out for is it actually thinking about the just order? Is it actually temperate? Is it actually, you know, think of all the virtues which are like fortitude, justice, you know, prudence, all of those types of things. Is this person who's doing the thinking really a virtuous person or not? Because if we are the ones who are originating values, then the culture is going to reflect the people who are the originators of values. And so once again, we have this scale of values, or the scale of values from vital, social, cultural, on up to personal values. And there's an influence that's going in both directions. Culture influences us, while at the same time, we influence culture as individual thinkers and valuers. So I think you probably I hope you're grasping what I'm saying there. So, you know, and this is an important thing. When we get around to talking about something later on, like Karl Marx, for example. Karl Marx, who was the founder of communism, well, he's one of the fathers of communism, let's put it that way. Karl Marx was a materialist. And he, one of his foundational insights for his system was that human intelligence is really, it is really simply the effect of material conditions in which you live. In other words, the social order, where are you in society? Are you a laborer? Are you a capitalist? Are you a serf living off of a lord's land or something like that? He says that his insight is that these material conditions determine how it is you think, how it is you value. And it's a one-way street. It only goes in that direction. What Lonergan is saying is there is that element where those material conditions do impact our ability to think, but it also goes the other way. Our intellects are not fully determined by material conditions. We do have freedom, and intellect is something that's not just purely a passive recipient of sense perceptions, but rather it is, in fact, active. And it has this capacity to have insights into material conditions and to originate new insights. To be able to understand and grasp things, we're not just passive learners, we are active learners. And so, while culture, you can grow up in a certain culture, that does not mean that you are determined by the culture in which you live. You can also think abstractly and to think of the positives and the negatives of the conditions in which you live and how you need to be overcome certain obstacles. So at the same time, he's also recognizing that there's such a thing as sin. There's such a thing as bias, which blinds us to what's truly good, and we start looking out for ourselves and so forth. And so instead of, you know, some person in university or whatever, or some, I don't know, NGO thinking, okay, well, let's create a system which favors this section of society at the expense of this society, there's an awfully obvious bias going on, and that happens. And so this is what Lonergan's talking about, is that we are originators of values, and we impact culture. In the same way, we have to recognize culture impacts us. We can't just simply pretend that we're born in a vacuum, because we're not. So, does that make sense? Everyone's sort of okay with that. Now, finally, he talks about religious values. For him, this means the Holy Spirit in a Christian's life that transforms our being, our volitions, our intellect, so that we are reoriented to God, to loving God, and to loving one another. And in doing so, overcoming various biases, whether it's personal selfish bias, whether it's group bias, whether it's more long-term bias of a culture, whatever, religious values, authentic religious values, changes the person, and the person changes the culture. The culture changes the economic order, the social order, the political order, which in turn makes for a more just distribution of vital goods towards society. So this here is what you would call a heuristic way of thinking of things. Heuristic just means a helpful way of thinking of things. It doesn't mean that that everything here is like something that you can prove through science or something like that. It just means this is a way of thinking about the order in which we live. And in our case, we're focusing on culture, but also the personal values of ourselves as originators of value, and thinking about how it is that we impact culture while culture impacts us. So
how does cancel culture work into this?
Cancel culture, I would say, is born out of group bias. I would say cancel culture is born out of group bias.
Okay.
It's very active, yes. In fact, cancel culture would be a good, and we'll get into this as we move down the line. Cancel culture owes a lot to the Marxist tradition, but there was a change that happened in the Marxist tradition. Even Karl Marx, towards the end of his life, wasn't so much a materialist as he was to begin with. He began to recognize a little bit more that, well, it's not just that we're completely passively determined by our social conditions. We do, and in fact, we can impact culture. And so, so his novel theory wasn't necessarily carried through. And of course, that was, I think there aren't too many people who think that way anymore. A number of changes have happened within the Marxist world. So the Frankfurt School, which was, we'll get into later on, which was very influential and critical. They're the originators of what we call the critical theory or critical race theory. It came from there, which was a Marxist school. And so we'll get into that. But they've developed a more, for them, rather than going after, as the old Marxists did, going after the political order, they went after culture. They realized that politics was downstream from culture. You win the culture, you win the cultural institutions, you take over the political order, everything is yours. So
what's happening in our school system?
What's happening in our school system is
disastrous.
It's absolutely disastrous. And I think some people articulated that grave concern last week. And we'll get into that as we move along. What we want to do is to look at backup, look at worldviews in general, and then start getting down to the nitty-gritty. What is the story? What is the narrative that developed? Where you can go from a Western society, which maybe was divided between Christians among denominational lines, but everybody still identified, at least culturally, as Christian, to a point now where people barely even know who Jesus was, other than a curse word. So, there's a story, and the thing is, we're in this period of time where culture is changing so rapidly. But like I said, who holds onto the cultural institutions and power right now? And there's where you'll find, whether it's academia, whether it's the entertainment industry, whether it's the sports world, it's all going, as it were, woke. You can see that. So, but that's not accidental. That's not unplanned. There are people who have been intentionally striving for this for years. And we'll look at some of who the people were who were striving for this very thing. And when we get around to it. But so where do we identify some of that stuff in this picture? Just recognize that there are people who have biases. Now, we all have to be wary of our own biases. But just remember that as Christians, our relationship with God should be directing us to the point where those biases are expunged. We're still humans. We're still going to fail. But, if we're going to redeem the world, we also have to be sanctified ourselves. If we're going to participate in God's redemption of the world, we have to be very much concerned about our own sanctification. And nobody should ever think that they've reached the full limit of it within this life, because it's just not happening. It's just not a reality. But while we live in this period of the already but not yet, we're still called. God still calls us, and this is an amazing thing. Despite ourselves, God still calls us to engage culture and to help and to be his means by which the world is reached with the gospel. And so hopefully that this discussion of the scale of values is helpful, and as we move down the road, hopefully it's something that we can maybe think back upon and say, well, that kind of helps us make sense of things. So, next thing, cultural change. when what binds us together changes. Culture binds us together. The meanings and values that we share in common makes us a community. We're not lone wolves. We have a life lived together. We are, as some of the ancient philosophers would say, we're social animals. We're social creatures by our very nature. We need each other. You know, how long does it take a human being from the moment of infancy to grow up to adulthood compared to most other animals? We live in a world in which we are so dependent upon one another that we have to form communities, but we're also sort of gregarious by nature. We need each other's company, and there are a few people who can, you know, live a very isolated life, but for the most part, the rule is we need each other. And so that's why we form societies like we do. But meanings and values change. They're not static. And there have been periods in history where you have a relatively static cultures. That's not to say, though, that they're not changing, and they do change. We're seeing sort of hyper-change going on right now. It's change at a level, you know, and it's hard to keep up with everything that's going on. It's impossible to keep up with everything that's going on. So meanings and values are not static. The classical liberal and progressive understandings of social progress is that of a continued historical progress. So if you were to think back, so there's a this, when historians look at history, they see these, they divide history up into these various periods. So sometimes you hear things like the classical era, the medieval era, the Renaissance era, the Enlightenment era, the Victorian period, and then, you know, modernity, post-modernity, and so forth. Well, there was periods back in like the 17, 1800s, which they referred to as, we now refer to as the Enlightenment. As the word kind of means, it's like as if a light went on. So this is the period of science, the period of, you know, science is just beginning to explode onto the scene. Science had been done for centuries before that and been practiced going back into the Middle Ages, but it developed and then it really begins to explode onto the scene. And the world began to look at things very optimistically. If science is progressing and technology is progressing, we're making all these strides, soon we'll be able to completely understand, you know, everything there is to understand about the world, and, you know, we can solve all of these problems. And so it was a period of optimism because of science. We still get a bit of that feel going on in today's generation as well, although it's been radically tempered, probably by two world wars and amongst other things. But the classical liberal, and we're born in that, Canada, United States especially, was born in this classical liberal period. United States is sort of the, you know, epitome of that era in terms of understanding what the liberal, so when we think of it, we think of this order in which we've overcome these wars, religious wars between Protestants, Catholics, Protestants versus Protestants. Now we're looking, instead of to God, we're looking more to science as sort of our master. And science is going to lead us onto this future utopia. So the classical liberal was kind of a utopian. They looked at the future and they saw everything was bright. We're on this continuous path of progress. Now that we've got science with us, now we can progress. Now that we've put in place a political order that's, you know, done away with the monarchies, it's done away with all of the emperors and so forth, now we can really progress as society. And so that captured the imagination of many people back in the time. Socialism, same idea. Karl Marx was a utopian. You read his writings and you think the guy just stole everything from Christianity, because basically what he did was turn almost Christianity on its head, completely eschatological view of reality. We have a problem. He had an understanding of the problems of society. He didn't call it sin. He usually called it something like capitalism or something like that. And then how we overcome it? Well, he had his idea of how you overcome it from by human means, or how it will naturally come about, really, for him, how history was determined in a certain direction. So there's no providential God guiding history. History itself is on this inevitable forward movement. And when everything happens, capitalism will collapse. A communist bureaucracy, the proletariat will rise up against the bourgeois. That's to say, the laboring class will rise up against the wealthy owners of the companies and so forth. They will then eliminate all the inequalities in society, and then you will have true utopia. So you expunge personal sin, you put in its place class warfare, and then you eliminate class warfare, then you end up with utopia. It's eschatological, without God. So anyways, they both have this view of progression, forward progression in history. And so when you hear of, political parties that have the word progress in them, like progressive conservative, and so forth, and you hear the word bandied about all the time, progress, 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 this goes back centuries. It's not a new term. It's been around for a while. And it's basically a view that we're on this inevitable course. Remember, you hear these people, politicians, oftentimes saying, you'll be judged by history, not by God. You'll be judged by history, which is to say there's an inevitable path of history. It's working its way out, and you will just be a footnote in history at some point in time, because our view is going to win out in the end. So this positive view of progress, now that is not a biblical view. The biblical view is that history is a mix of progress and decline. It's a mix of progress and decline because of human sin. Yes, you have a question?
Can we relate what you just said to the native culture right now, what they've gone through and what the government is apologizing for having done, and so it is progressing to better things for the natives compared to the way they were treated?
So I don't know the full history of what's going on there, but...
I'm thinking of the school system and what they had.
Yeah, so the question is that sort of relating this idea of progress, which is still sort of present in the thinking of many people, back to what's going on in the school system within the indigenous communities and so forth. And so the narrative that's created is that the schools that were set up were almost, did injustices upon the indigenous community, their children and so forth. And so we need to make amends for those injustices.
But then we looked at Prime Minister McDonald and how he has been crucified, for lack of a better word, by history because he set the system up or approved of the system.
Yeah, I don't know the history, and so I can't get in too much because I don't know. Sometimes you just have to back off of certain issues and get your head into certain ones. And so I don't know enough of that. I think Rachel's explored that a little bit more than I have, and she would have more to say. Other than I'll say this, is you always have to be careful of narratives that are being written or that are being portrayed, whether by the politicians or by the academic elites. All I can say is in Rachel... if you want to talk to her later on about this, is that there's the narrative that's presented within the newspapers, by the media, by the politicians, but then there's what some of the academics who are actually historians think about what really happened. And they say, you're not exactly telling the truth about everything that went on. And so this is where, this is what this is all about. And again, if we want to go down deeper into this issue, we can do it at some point in these lectures, and I'd have to do more research in order to do that. But whether it's the indigenous issues, whether it's LGBT issues, whether it's race issues or whatnot, which are issues that get prioritized at the Uber level in our society.
Prime Minister at the time, years later, that Prime Minister he did so much good for the country. He did one thing that he's been said he did wrong, so he loses his value.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and so then they start removing statues of Sir John A. Macdonald and stuff like that, as if he had no value whatsoever. So, as a Christian, first of all, you don't put anybody up on a pedestal, whether it's Sir John A. Macdonald, because he was not a perfect man, or anybody. But neither do you put our prime minister up on a pedestal either and say that everything he says and does is, you know, as if spoken by some great grand guru who has great wisdom. There are narratives that are created, and this is why I say a culture, and you think of cultural institutions. Eventually we'll probably get into some of the writings and stuff like that. There are writings that are explicitly put out there to rewrite history, to change the narrative, to hide the full truth of history. Now, there's a saying that, about history is written by the victors, and there is some truth to that, because when we think of history, we have to select data. Not everything is relevant. If you're writing a book on history, you can't read everything. You're limited. You're a finite person. You can't read everything. You can't take everything into account. So you have to select your data, and you have to be able to, understand that data. And you're usually appealing to other authorities in order to help get a sense of what's going on and what is going on and so forth in order to write your... And so there is no such thing as history that's written from a, perfectly objective God viewpoint. Only God can write that history. But despite our limitations, our human limitations, we can reflect upon whether we're actually misconstruing the data with intention or not with intention, and we can correct our own errors. And so we do need, when it comes to history, we need, and this is why we really need to Christians need to be engaged in culture precisely for this reason, so that they are themselves historians, they are themselves philosophers, they are themselves economists, and so forth, and they can contribute to the church and its own understanding, a proper understanding, as best as we can humanly do, about whether it's the indigenous schools or whatnot. So this is the thing where Christians... If you disengage from culture, and this is the danger, who takes its place? Who's running the system? And, there was a book written back in the 1980s, specifically focused on evangelicals. It was called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. I think the writer's name was Mark Knoll. And his argument is that reason why culture is being lost by Christians to all these other anti-Christian viewpoints is precisely because we abandoned the institutions. And I think that's a big part of it. There's another book that's more recently been written by Carl Truman, which was in response to Mark Knoll's book. Carl's book, and he also makes a valid point. His point is to qualify is that, it's not completely that Christians fully abandoned the institutions. There are Christians in the institutions, but they went along with everything else. They never stood up for the biblical worldview. It's both. So remember, Christ against culture, evangelicalism abandons the cultural institutions and starts creating their own little inner world of culture, in the hopes that the world won't impose itself on them. Well, it's doing that pretty strongly at the moment. So that was a missed shot in the dark. But the importance of, if you're in those institutions, do you have the courage to stand up for what you know is right and true? And a lot of Christians didn't and haven't. they gave in and they succumbed to the culture, and they just do this, they go along to get along. So a lot of, we'll get, there's a little video I'm going to show here very soon where by Roger here, and he's going to sort of talk a little bit about that, about how Christians who do speak out are losing their positions and in those institutions and so forth. So what we have coming upon us now is a bit of a soft totalitarianism. So I'm getting the indication that we're just about due for a break, or we are due for a break. We are due for... True.
So this may be a good time for a break.
Okay. Let's do a break. While you're breaking, think about sort of what's on the head, on the top of your head, and then we'll just sort of go around and we'll just allow that to be shared. So we'll take 10 minutes. So we'll gather back here in about 10 after. It looks like somebody's still working on their homework, so...
it's up to God, obviously, but to speak to them. Like, you can ask questions. So we were having a conversation at a barbecue. I was talking to my nephew, and he's a 20-something, and he had said, I just want everyone to be happy. And my question was to him is, are they, though? So I guess, yeah, that's my biggest concern, is just connecting the dots, and is it... It just feels like it's too far gone. You know, that's the struggle.
Sure.
I know it's not, but I mean, in due time, but yeah.
Okay, thanks. Mark?
Oh, just everything. But it's like every week there's some radical change that just blows, well, you get used to it, I guess, when you see it. I always talk to Gerald and I say, shouldn't get too caught up in it, but I just take, observe it, and it's like, well, one, I thought it was horrible that they had drag queens teach preschoolers in the library story time. I go, what stories, fairy tales, or not to be joking, but then next I'm hearing about they're doing the same thing in Sunday school, and it, that's the radical, and it's a fast-paced thing. And it's almost like we've allowed something to creep in, and they just want to push the envelope a little bit more. And as you were saying, somebody's behind it. Well, Satan, of course, but it's all, and when you take it all together, you can't help but look at it as, are we in the end times?
Right. Okay, so, yeah, I'm picking up sort of both with respect to Tracy and yourself. It's what's pushing all of this? And where's it coming from? And it's, which manifests itself in a myriad of ways, but where's it all coming from? And yes, let's continue on down the line here. Yeah.
I guess my biggest concern is the next generation coming, the children, the world they're coming into. And other than if they've got Christian parents, they're being taught by government down to the school system, as far as I can see, they all know their rights and what they can do and what they can claim and what they're owed. But they don't have any of the real values of life, the real what's going to make it through.
Okay.
So I'm very concerned for the next generation coming, if we're here that long.
Sure.
They need to be helped.
Yes.
So they can get through it.
Yeah, so
they need God to do that.
So there the emphasis is upon really the education, the upbringing of the next generation of children. Yeah. Burl?
I'm listening to Buck when I was thinking of your focus. And I'll just read it to you. It says, the strength of any explanation depends on the plausibility.
Yes, Actually, it's, I don't know, maybe we'll get into logical and critical reasoning at some point, because that's right in line with that, what's being meant by that saying there. Yes. John?
I think from a cultural standpoint, the change that's really radically happened that bothers me the most is there's no authority left except yourself. You know, and there's nothing above me that can change my mind. Like when I was a young guy, I saw people radically saved, went from darkness to light. They went from being a rebel to being a follower of Christ. I haven't seen that in 20 years. Have you ever seen anybody radically change lately?
Not for the better.
Because they don't believe this anymore.
Yeah. So
no authority.
So thank you.
We can't engage our culture because they don't believe this.
Yeah. So we're actually, you just raised an issue that once we get through the world views, we're going to address directly. And it's called expressive individualism. The history behind it and how that has led to things like the sexual revolution. The chief author for that is Carl Truman. He wrote two books, the one sort of the academic version, the other is the popular version. We'll be going through this. It's called the big version, the academic versions, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, Cultural Amnesia, Expressive Individualism, The Road to the Sexual Revolution. Yeah. The more popular level is Strange New World, A Take on A Brave New World from Aldous Huxley. And so just so you know, we're exactly heading down that. So for those who have this interest, like, why is all this happening? There's a history. There's a history of ideas. And it's not just ideas, it's events, things that have taken place that it's not one person who's responsible for it. It's not one group that's responsible for it. It's a snowball effect of various different things coming together to generate what we have today. But we can identify, as historians, key individuals, key movements, key events that have taken place that have drawn us to this point of where we are, where there is a complete, utter withdrawal, not just from a biblical worldview. There are other worldviews, which we've gone through phases of, like deism and so forth, which are being set aside as well. So anyways, that's just a bit of a foretaste of what's to come. Norman? So the claim that this is my truth. And so the denial of absolute truth, and that's kind of right in line with what John was talking about there, where you get into this expressive individualism, which is about my truth, my reality.
Mine is very similar in the sense that the anchor of absolutes is gone, particularly moral absolutes and biblical absolutes. But secondarily, that how easily progressivism
and mine is, I think of, you know, we get hopeful with our leaders because we want a leader that leads us in this world, in a more righteous path. And so we see that both, or all in the House, in our government, voted for, against. You know, get help out of it. And they all voted, and I said to my husband, I'm very disappointed in that, well, we all are, no doubt, but that if they call, which they do every now and then call us, I definitely want to tell them that we're really disappointed in all of the parties, that the Conservative Party especially could not stand. They all voted against, the same with the other parties. And so I think they're, all these people are held, what they do to a child is murdering a child, in essence, their minds and growing up like everybody else and coming into this world, and how are they going to,
Yep. So Linda's comment was that she's disappointed with, you know, even the politicians, the political system, but even the politicians sort of had faith in to make the right decisions, and yet they cowarded in the end. This is what we mean when we talk about politics is downstream from culture. When culture changes, you know, politicians realize that their ability to get elected depends upon their ability to get cash from certain corporations and businesses and the hoi polloi, the grassroots people. And if culture has moved enough, your politician's probably going to move with the culture. And what's meant by like conservatism, it simply means in this day and age almost liberalism, but taken a little bit more slowly. So rather than here and now, well, we'll wait and see another 12 months from now, where it used to be. Maybe 10 years from now, or it will change our minds. So anyways, you can't trust the political order, and this is why we have to talk about these things at the level of culture and the level of our local areas, and we need to build up networks within the Christian communities and even those who aren't necessarily part of the Christian community but who recognize something is wrong. I was talking with Andrew Ward last night, and of course he's in the field of counseling, and he's at the base in Trenton, and he said he had this veteran come in and talk to him. He's not a Christian, but he says, this is wrong. What's going on around us is wrong, and I have a problem with it. And he's kind of searching, he's looking at churches and stuff like that, and he's like, how is it these churches have, they're no different than what everybody else is saying? And so we need to build up networks. And you may find yourself partnering and finding friends in places you might not have expected. But, you know, I have one thing that I'm reasonably confident of. There is such a thing as the natural law that's been written on human hearts. It's obscured by sin, but it's there. And there are people who don't know the gospel, but who do have something of a moral conscience. And they're aware that something is not right, and they don't know which way to go. And they're probably going to go the way of culture, because what other choice do they have? They don't have a moral foundation to stand on. So what else do they have to stand on other than, but I feel this way? There was a NHL player who plays for the Philadelphia Flyers who did not participate in their LGBT celebrations. He was confronted by the media, of course, and he said, I need to stay true to myself, which he's an Orthodox Christian from Russia. And I have a mixed reaction to that. He's right to stand against it, but it was his answer that bothered me, because it's the same, his justification is, this is my truth. And this is the problem which Jerry and Norman have mentioned, that the standard of absolute truth is gone. It's like, this is the way I feel about it, and I just need to stay true to myself. Well, who's the source of your truth? And so, and maybe he was just saying that because obviously the pressures were against them. You face the media, what are you going to say in that moment? You know, but he did say, you know, he was being true to his religion and to himself. So, but part of that answer is there's some truth in that if your conscience is properly formed, staying true to yourself is staying true to God. But there's a giving in that same, because we know the connotations of what it means in culture. But anyways, let us proceed. Barb.
Is that Month, okay, and Pride Month. And I heard a person say the other day, a leader of a big parade said, we, they are the majority now, and we are the minority. And are we stand? And what bothers me, are we standing up enough? Like, just like this player said, I'm being true to myself. Why did he say that? Are we bold enough to say, I'm being true to Jesus, or I'm being true to God?
Yeah.
And I find, just as already mentioned, what difference do they see in the church and out in the world? You know, we have people living together in the world. We have people living together in the church. We have people doing this out, and we have to, is there a difference? Yes.
Okay, thanks, Barb.
I just see
them a lot different. No, I hear you. So, Bernadette?
Well, I see, like, in the 70s there was free sex, and then the abortion started. They started killing babies, it's been going on. They took away the prayers in the schools,
It's been a gradual building up of, it's like a snowball going down a field, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger.
Priests that were molesting kids, and kids were being molested, it's going on. It's as if it's the devil that has the control.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so it's, yeah, one wonders how long it's going to be before, pedestry is going to be legalized,
Yeah.
I remember talking to a friend back when the Canadian courts shut down opened up the gates for legalization of gay marriage. And I said, I was talking to him, and we were on different sides of on the field of the whole gay marriage debate. I was, of course, opposed, and he had no problem with it. And I said to him, you've just eliminated any standard whatsoever for why a marriage is what it is. It's a union of a man and a woman with the goal of procreation. You eliminate the biological element, there is no justification. It's simply, sex becomes a recreational activity, and all it is two people getting together, engaging in an act which is no different than playing soccer. There is no justification. It doesn't matter whether it's one man and two women or two women and one man. There is no boundary to it. But then how long is it going to be before our cultural quibbles, even about the sanctity of a child, the protection of a child, before that comes to an end? And there are already people pushing for that in higher institutions. There are people, professors, already writing papers saying, we need to get over this cultural qualm that we have because of over, adults, and children being able to, and that is, I can't imagine, it's hard to know how low culture can sink. And I can't imagine it, how it could possibly sink below that. But I'll guarantee you it can. So we're heading down that road.
James. My thought is, as the Bible says, we're in a famine for the Word of God. Even Christians have Bibles in their homes, lots of us, and we don't read the Bible. We don't know what it says. And that it's a famine where we're getting come to a place where we're blind to God's Word, to know what's in there. The answers are all in there, and Satan's having a field day drawing our culture down the tubes, all these terrible things that are happening. And like John says, authority.
Yeah, and I think I'm hearing from you as well that Christians don't even know their own beliefs well enough. Christians don't even know their own beliefs well enough.
Tracy and I just watched something just before we came, actually, that we watched too, and it was more of a statistic-wise, with evangelical, this was within the evangelical circle, of how the Bible is not seen as true.
Yep.
pieces of the Bible, but to suit their culture.
Yes.
Church.
Yeah.
Yeah. If Satan gets us so we don't leave the Bible or we ignore it or whatever, then he's got us.
Yeah. So people pick and choose what their truth is. So what's going on? So, and so let's move on to Debbie. Yeah, those are the, so the concern there is, you know, when you confront somebody, like in the case of a person in the trans movement, how as a Christian do you display love while at the same time saying, I'm sorry, but I can't accept what it is I can't affirm that your choice was a good one. And you may be surprised that some people within that movement may not necessarily be offended with you saying that I cannot affirm that, depending on how it is that you actually engage them. But yeah, this is stuff we have to think about, which generations in the past did not have to think about. They had other issues, but this was not one of them. And so, yes, exactly. So, and I have to think through that myself because I've never been in that situation yet. So, to be honest with you. Yeah. And Keith? No, I know I can identify with that. I've been in that situation, and I made my choice. That's why I'm here. But in terms of the whole vaccination thing, that's my little road that I walked down. But there's a time. It's a prudential judgment. There's a time to say something, and sometimes there's a time you might have to bite your lip. But ultimately, there's a point where we have to tell the truth. And the telling the truth is what has to happen for cultural change. You cannot hide the truth. The question is how do you tell the truth to this generation in a way that they're willing to listen? And so there are some assumptions that we all make. And sometimes when you go at those assumptions that people have, and we begin to question those assumptions, they begin to start thinking for themselves that maybe I'm wrong. So, you know, sometimes you get into discussions where you just say it as it is. Other times you plant seeds. And so the whole, you know, importance of the virtue of prudence is all about knowing what to say and when to say it. And in what manner you say it. So
I think you're right, Wayne. It's not so much in anything what is said as much as how it's said.
Yes, exactly.
Like if you're defensive and you say something, then they get defensive. Where if you say it in a loving manner, then they're more apt to.
And there's no guarantee that people will respond, you know, positively to that. There may be some people who are so dug in, you know, and there are people who will not repent. That's the history of humanity, is there are people who will not repent.
If you look to the Bible, lots of times there's stories in there that tell us how to respond by the way Jesus did.
Yeah, so we need to be, that's part of understanding what making a prudential judgment is by looking at the example of others who were prudent and wise. And of course, Jesus is the paradigm for that. Yeah. And Caleb?
Well, personally, I'm worried about the young men of this country, basically. So, like, the way, or just in general, because I grew up fairly recently. But, I notice now, not so much when I was younger, but I notice now that school systems are very based on And I know with me personally, I couldn't learn very easily. Like it was a lot harder. I had to take my time to learn and all that stuff. But I also know in general, young men, I noticed that they take a lot of time. They like to learn slow. They like to understand things step by step. And I noticed that the school system is more, like I said, moving on a lot quicker. So I've noticed that the men have started to slowly get behind and all that stuff. And actually, there's a study done in like the early 2000s of four rat communities that they put it into, like, I don't know. But they ended up like giving them a plethora of food, like it was an oasis for rats, basically. And what they noticed was generations of rats later, they noticed that the men started to get less, like they weren't as like used as much, like they weren't as required in civilization. So what happened was the men started to, like the men rats started to get like not useful. They just started to get like lazy and all that stuff. And then the women started to take off and do their own thing. And eventually it started to get to the fact that the women would actually attack the rats, the men rats, and kill them. And then the entire civilization died because they couldn't reproduce. So I'm really worried about that because...
Yeah, so...
I'm worried that the men nowadays aren't as...
engaged?
Engaged or rugged as...
Yes. Yeah, so there's a history to be told about what's going on, and it's kind of like the psychological emasculation of men in society. And a lot of that goes back to the feminist movement. The educational system is built that way, but hey, look at our own churches. We're the men. So there's a problem in-house just as much. And it's because the church has taken on the culture. And like I said, there's some good things in culture and there's some bad things. And the inability to make that proper judgment and to know where to say, to take your stand and say, sorry, but we're going in a different direction because where you're going is dangerous. So... So the phenomena of, they have a term called incels for men who basically can't find a date, and so they basically live their lives in complete despair and with hatred towards women. That's a social creation. Completely, that is not something that would be a phenomenon back in any other culture but today's culture. And so there are a lot of conditions. So the feminist movement's a big thing, but there are other things as well going on. Caleb?
One thing that I watched a couple videos of, like, well, not a couple, actually, I watched one of them, of it, but there was this guy
Yeah. No, there have been books written by feminists who basically come out and say that. Yeah. So that helps to explain also why there is a gay lesbian movement to begin with, because women had such a hatred based on, they mixed together Marxism and the whole notion, Marxist notion of alienation. They took it from the economic sphere and they applied it to genders. And so rather than the bourgeoisie, the rich company-owning people, being the oppressor becomes the white male in particular, but males in general, and the oppressed is the woman. And so what do you do with the oppressor? You got to get rid of them. And so how do women live in society without a male thing? Well, you have two choices. Either you kill off the men, or you emasculate the men and turn them into women. So those are your two choices. And so feminism, you probably hear about J.K. Rowling, who wrote some popular books back in the day. She's an ardent feminist, but of a certain type. Of the type that was more on the long lines of men are oppressors, in order for this dichotomy of oppressor-oppressed to stand, men have to be really men and women have to be really woman in order for that dichotomy to exist. You eliminate that, you eliminate gender, you make it relative, and everything becomes all, there's no such thing as gender, really. Then there's no such thing as a feminist movement, because there's no such thing as femininity, or masculinity, for that matter. Everything's relative. So that's the road, that's an internal debate that goes on within the feminist movement and culture at large. And one side's winning over the other at the moment. But I'd like to just finish off with a few notes here, talking about cultural change. So 5 minutes, we will close off. I will just breeze through these notes. I would like to still show that video, and then we'll close off with that. So major changes in the Western world. The Protestant Reformation was a huge change. It set off, it started off a process in which led to a number of things happening, which in some ways leads to where we are today. But it's at the very beginning. The world's still Christian at that time, and still sees the thing through a Christian worldview. The scientific revolution, the technological growth, and industrialism that comes along had a huge impact. Everything goes from being a very rural society where people basically lived off their own farm, and you lived on what you could grow. And if the weather wasn't great that year, then boy, are you in trouble. But if the weather was good, thank goodness we have a little surplus. Maybe we can sell something. You go from that type of living to moving to cities, working in factories, mass production, the growth of technology, and everything takes off. And then you have that liberal optimism about the future, that we're heading towards utopia. So things like the printing press, modern genetics, division of labor, all those things had huge impact on culture. Political revolutions. The French, the Russian Communist Revolution, the Chinese Communist Revolution. All of those revolutions have go back to the changes of ideas, but they also have to do with the changes in technology and development that is going on, like industrialism and stuff like that. You don't have Karl Marx unless you have the birth of industrialism and the division of labor. So wars, World War I, World War II, the optimism of the liberal order came to a grinding halt after World War I. And then was birthed another movement called nihilism, which just means nothingness. There's no purpose, there's no meaning to life. And so we'll eventually get into that. Key sources of major change in the Western world. So we also have the development of ideas. So you have wars, you have industrialism, and stuff like that, these material factors. But you have the changing of ideas and the revolutions which they sometimes spawned. Capitalism, liberalism, Darwinism, social Darwinism, neo-Marxism, socialism, fascism, Nazism, neoliberalism, Chinese Communist Revolution through Maoism, Malthusianism, feminist movement, environmentalism, sexual revolution, and on and on and on. All of these things are percolating with certain seminal thinkers down through history. They get taken up in society, and it becomes so dominant that sometimes it leads to revolutions, such as the revolution in culture that we're seeing today. And the figures down at the bottom is from left to right, that's Charles Darwin. In the middle is Karl Marx. And the one on the right is Mao Zedong, the first communist leader of China and the biggest mass murderer on the face of the planet. Who's also prized highly within certain circles among socialists today. Symptoms of decline. How do you know when culture is declining? Well, we see a lot of this today. Loneliness, atomization, narcissism, nihilism. That's mean, like I said, nothingness. the loss of purpose and meaning. Relativism, relativization of truth, the relativization of the good, no absolutes. Hedonism, I do whatever I want that gets me the most pleasure. Occultism, the rise of ideologies, which is the rejection of truth for ideology, for your own idea. Loss of faith in cultural institutions, whether they're political, legal, media, religious, medical, educational, or entertainment. Forgetfulness, you forget your past. You have to, and sometimes you recreate it, you restructure it to fit your paradigm. A lack of identity and a lack of purpose. All of those things we see in our own culture, and they are signs of decline. There is no progress that we're looking at right now. We are seeing huge signs of decline. What are signs of strength and vitality? Strong communities, shared memories, shared identity, a sense of purpose and meaning both individually and collectively, a unified sense of what is true, what is right and wrong, what is beautiful, the love of God, the love of neighbor, trust in cultural institutions, a sense of ongoing improvement in one's social and economic conditions, freedom under the law, development of a virtuous society. All of those things we could say are signs of progress, signs of redemption. When you go from loneliness and despair and nihilism to a society where you begin to share, you have a shared common bond amongst each other, shared meanings and values. So I think it's right here where I'm going to just show a short video by Roger Hur. He's the writer of this book, Live Not by Lies. That's a title taken from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was a great Russian writer, anti-communist writer.
I remember back in 2015, the state of Indiana passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, state version of that. Big business got so angry at them that it threatened to take away economic privileges and take away business from the state if it didn't repeal this bigoted anti-LGBT law. Around that time, there was an attack on a little pizza parlor called Memories Pizza. It was run by an evangelical family in a small town in northern Indiana. TV station went there and asked the evangelical father and his daughter, would you serve gay people? He said, of course. They said, would you cater a gay wedding? No, we're Christians, it's against our belief. That went viral nationwide. There were overnight death threats against this pizza parlor. There were people tweeting out that we need to meet up in this town and burn this place down. This kind of thing was observed by an elderly Czech woman living in Michigan. And she said to her son, a doctor, son, the things that I'm seeing happen in America today, and she's talking about Memories Pizza, things I'm seeing happen in America today remind me of what happened in my own country, Czechoslovakia, when communism first arrived. But I said, you know what, maybe she's onto something. Maybe she sees something that the rest of us don't, because I don't remember ever seeing anything like the attack on this evangelical pizza parlor. So I began after that point, whenever I would travel to a conference or something, and I would meet someone who came to America from the Soviet bloc looking for freedom, I would say, so, for the things you're seeing in America today, does it remind you of what you left behind? And I would tell the story of the Czech woman. Every single one of them said yes. And if you talk to them long enough, they say that it makes them so angry that Americans don't take them seriously. They say Americans think, no, it can't happen here. What happened in Russia can't happen here. In fact, said Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great anti-Soviet dissident, what happened in Russia could happen in any country in the world under the right circumstances. It doesn't look like totalitarianism that we're used to from history. There are no gulags, no secret police, that sort of things. But it is totalitarianism. Here's some examples. Cancel culture is the main one today. The idea that people are at risk of losing their job, losing their reputation, losing even their physical safety if they say the wrong thing. They get on the wrong side of left-wing woke ideology. Soft totalitarianism in America looks like school boards that teach critical race theory and put it through their schools while they deny that they're doing it, and then they write to the government, as happened recently, to get the FBI to look into these protesting parents as potential domestic terror threats. Soft totalitarianism looks like this campaign that we're seeing throughout children's media to convince children to believe in gender fluidity. This soft totalitarianism has many, many manifestations. What's so interesting about it, though, is that it's not primarily coming through the government. It's primarily coming through the institutions of our liberal democracy that have been captured by the woke. It started with universities, then went to media, then went to big business, and it's now in law, in medicine, in sports, even in the U.S. military. And we're seeing the soft totalitarianism harden when you hear things, as I do all the time, from, say, professors inside universities who are seeing Christians being locked out of programs because they are judged by those the elites who administer the programs as not worthy, as bad people, because they don't believe in critical race theory and LGBT pride and so forth. All of these things are happening around us right now, but so many of us, ordinary Americans, don't see it as totalitarian because it doesn't look like the Soviet Union. It doesn't look like George Orwell. In my book, Live Not By Lies, I hear from people who survived actual hard totalitarianism, Christians who endured communism, who are trying to tell Americans, wake up. This is happening here in this country. The thing that we escaped from, come to freedom, a version of it is now coming here. But it's coming in a way that you're not accustomed to, so you don't see what's happening. We are so accustomed in the United States to living in a classically liberal culture. What I mean by that is a culture that values free speech, that values freedom of religion, that values the free market, and so on. This is what liberalism in a classical sense means. We have now passed beyond that into an illiberal, progressive culture, one in which they don't believe in fairness. And I come from the media. My background professionally is in newspapers. Over the course of my lifetime, we have gone from newspapers and all media trying to be fair to tell both sides of the story to a situation where media now only tells one side of the story, the left-wing, progressive, woke one, because they believe that there's only one truth. You're seeing this principle manifest itself through all kinds of institutions, and especially elite institutions. An important thing to realize is that the direction of a society is driven by its elites, any society. So when we look out today, wherever we might live, I live in South Louisiana, it's a fairly Christian place, a fairly conservative place. What we don't see is the power of elites within big business, within government, within universities, who are slowly strangling those liberties behind our backs, because they all share the same ideology, and that is the ideology, this wokeness, that you need if you want to join their inner circle. So my great fear for Christians is that we have passed beyond the classical liberal culture into this illiberal progressive culture, whereby if you want to have middle-class success, if you want to be a lawyer, a doctor, or succeed in business, you're going to have to sign off on this ideology of wokeness, or you will be kept from the outside. This is the great danger here. So many Christians think it can't happen here in America. Guess what? It is happening right now. We have to prepare ourselves right now as believers for persecution. Soft persecution is happening now, but the people who came to this country to escape communism, they tell me, every single one of them, that the persecution will not stay soft forever. I don't know if we can stop it. There are a lot of Christians who believe that if we just vote the right way, that's going to stop it. It's not true. I wish it were true. It would be easy then. But even if we elected a philosopher king as president, he could not stop a lot of this stuff because it's coming through the culture and from powerful producers of culture. I think we have to fight when we can. What happened in Virginia in November 2021 with the parents fighting back against critical race theory in schools, that's a great example. We need to see more of it. But even as we fight, we have to also prepare ourselves and prepare our communities and our churches for long-term persecution. Because if you look at the demographic studies, the younger generation, the millennials and Generation Z, many of them are falling away from the church. They don't understand why religious liberty is important. And they are likely going to sign on to persecution against traditional small follow Orthodox Christians as a matter of virtue. They're going to start seeing us, and they'll be told by the media and by big business that we are domestic threats, domestic terrorism threats. What are we going to do as a church when that happens? I dedicated my book, Live Not By Lies, to the memory of this Catholic priest named Father Tomislav Kolakovic. I'm not a Catholic, but this man is a hero, an unsung hero. In 1943, he was doing work against the Nazis in his native Zagreb in Croatia. When he got a tip that the Gestapo was coming for him, he escaped and went to his mother's homeland, the country of Slovakia, and began teaching in a university there. He told his students, the good news is the Germans are going to lose. The bad news is that the Soviets are going to be ruling this country when it's over. And the first thing they're going to do is persecute the church. So what he began to do was prepare small groups for the resistance. He would bring these groups together for prayer, but also for study and deliberation on what they could do to build the underground church networks now in a time of freedom. Within 2 years, these groups had spread all over Slovakia. Every town of any size had one. Now, here's the thing. The Catholic bishops of that country, they chastised him. They said, Father, you're scaring people. You're being alarmist. It will never happen here. But Father Kolakovic knew otherwise because he had studied totalitarianism. He knew how it worked, and he could see the signs of it. He kept up his work. Sure enough, in 1948, when the Iron Curtain fell over that country, first thing the communists did was persecute the church. The fact that there was an underground church in that country for 40 years is because Father Kolakovic and the young people who heeded his warning and built the underground church, because they did that when they were free to do so. I believe that we are in a Kolakovic moment in America today. We shouldn't be afraid. The Lord tells us not to be afraid, but we should also be sober-minded and get about the business of building these networks and building these groups right now, so we'll be able to help each other stand firm in Christ no matter what the world presents.
Okay, one thing you didn't say there was that in the 1980s, that underground church came out from underground, and they got together and they started demonstrating. They had what was known as the Candle Revolution. Well, they were quashed, but then a year later was what was known as the Velvet Revolution. And that was the end of Czechoslovakia as a communist country. It fell a year afterwards. And so, you know, that was the underground church. And it took years for that to happen. But anyways, what he's focusing here on is that, you know, we need to build networks. We need to have foresight to what's going on, be able to read what's going on in culture. And that, to me, is what we're doing here and what other churches need to be doing as well. So let's close in prayer. Our Father, we just thank you for this time together. There are a whole lot of issues going on in society, which we know we don't have much control over, but you are sovereign. Nothing happens apart from your will. And Lord, may you just give us strength during this moment and during this time to be what you call us to be. And we do pray, Father, for the redemption of this culture. You have done marvelous things throughout history, and every attempt to rise up against your church has ultimately failed. And we just pray, Father, that the gates of hell will not prevail against us. So, Lord, just be with us now as we go, and bring us together again and in the near future, and just equip us for the task you have at hand. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
For everybody, so we only had two sessions planned. Is there an interest to continue through the summer every week or once a month?